We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Welcome to Special Edition. I'm Paula Degnan. This week, we'll celebrate National Law Enforcement Appreciation Day, hear from a local physician about getting back to a new normal. We'll also find out how COVID-19 affects the environment. But we'll start off by meeting Scott Seaborg. He's the Pennsylvania Director of All Voting is Local. We're getting ready for the June 2nd primary, and it's going to be different this year.
What is the organization All Voting is Local?
So All Voting is Local is all about helping folks vote safely in this pandemic. We're a nonprofit, and we're focused on removing barriers between people and their ballot boxes, as well as doing robust voter education, making sure folks have the information that they need to successfully and safely cast a ballot in their elections.
I must say, this year is probably, I wouldn't even know. Unprecedented seems to be the only word that comes to mind with all of this. So how is, there are so many ways, but how in particular for you and your organization is this election been challenging this year more so than in other years because everything is being rewritten?
Well, absolutely. You know, it's been challenging in several ways. One, I think no one expected this pandemic to happen, point blank. Right. This has definitely upset the apple cart in many facets of our lives. And because the traditional person-to-person voter education at the community level is more difficult now, All Voting is Local is really focused on shining a bright light on our deadlines. So one of the big pieces of information that folks need to know is that the primary has been rescheduled, right? And it's actually going to happen on June 2nd now, instead of back in late April. And due to that, we're doing everything we can to make sure that folks know the dates leading up to that really important primary. One's the voter registration deadline, May 18th, and the other one is the vote by mail ballot request deadline, which is on May 26th. And folks have new tools in the state to be able to vote by mail and vote at home, and we're encouraging folks to utilize those options should they want to make that choice.
A lot of people, when they hear about mail-in ballot, they automatically think, well, that's only for absentee, but I'm going to be here. Can you give us just a brief overview of how and all of the changes that came about with that?
Absolutely. There's been a policy change in Pennsylvania, and fortunately it was well-timed to happen before the pandemic started wreaking havoc in our communities. And the biggest change coming out of this Act 77 was that in Pennsylvania, voters no longer need to cite a reason in order to request a vote by mail ballot or to vote at home. They're able to request that ballot through the online website votespa.com and receive their ballot at home, where they're able to cast their ballot in the privacy and security of a socially distanced space, as well as send that back to the state for that ballot to be counted. Now, this is a tool that allows folks to sort of do the socially distance thing while they're participating in their democracy and making their voice heard at the ballot box, but that's not to say that there won't be in-person polling places at the same time. We know that voters with disabilities and voters with limited English proficiency really rely on those in-person polling places. And so it's great that the state is able to offer expanded vote-by-mail options as well as the traditional in-person polling places our communities rely on.
And those in-person polling places are also going to be faced with their own challenges because of the amount of people that will not be coming out as poll workers. So I know here in Northeast Pennsylvania, in particular in Luzerne County, they've already consolidated polling places. So is that something else that people are going to have to now become aware of, that if they go to their polling place, it may be somewhere else?
Absolutely. And this is all part of our continued, I think, flexibility around how to administer this election in the state while we're dealing with COVID-19 and the pandemic. One of the things that we're looking forward to doing as these in-person polling places get announced by county is really working through state partners to get the word out as far as where are these polling places at and how can you access them. One important resource is 1-866-OUR-VOTE, which is a hotline that you can call to get information on your polling place or any other voter and election-related question.
I know that there are also a lot of people concerned about mail-in ballots for so many different reasons. And now they're also concerned about the polling places because, again, there have been changes in voting machines. Now there could be changes in your polling place. And since the people who have been poll workers that are familiar faces for so many years might not be there. So training poll workers has now become an issue as well. Have you found that in other parts of the state too?
Well, I think that election officials all over the state are working as hard and as fast as they can to adapt what they are typically doing for elections in this time of pandemic, right? And so I think that there are best practices coming from the state in terms of how to keep those poll workers safe. And the training is definitely going to need to reflect the ability to do social distancing in those polling places and make sure that not only the folks that are there to cast their ballots, but the people that are there to help administer that experience stay safe and are able to have their voices heard.
And for the people who are concerned, what would you say to them, Scott, from your point of view, since you're out there on the forefront getting this message out to the general public?
Absolutely. You know, what I would say is with everything going on, it's really important that everyone participates in this election and does it safely. One thing I can assure folks about the vote by mail balloting is that this is an option that's existed in Pennsylvania for many years, and it's performed very well. It's a secure way to vote, and it's also a way where you can keep yourself and your family safe from the pandemic. And so as folks are sort of looking at these deadlines for May 18th voter registration to request their mail-in ballot by May 26th, I think they can do it with the knowledge that casting that vote by mail ballot is a secure experience, and it's also something that can keep you safe as well as your family by not needing to engage in places where you potentially would be able to pick up the pandemic.
You also mentioned Votes PA, but you also had another resource. Can you give us that information once again? Was that how to get in touch with your folks at All
Voting
PA?
Yeah, there's a resource. It is a hotline, 866-OUR-VOTE, and that is a number that is going to be answered by election experts that are a part of our organization and partner organizations that can help with voter education, information and deadlines, as well as helping to locate where your in-person polling places are. You can also visit allvotingislocal.org.
Thanks again to Scott Seaborg, the Pennsylvania Director of All Voting is Local, for joining us today on Special Edition and, of course, reminding us of those important dates and giving us the information as far as getting in touch with them or votespa.com or, of course, your local election officials. Now, don't go away. When we come back, we're going to find out all about National Law Enforcement Day. It was celebrated earlier this week, and Intercom's Frank Andrews and Mark Davis will be here to bring you two guests involved in law enforcement. Don't go away. Welcome back to Special Edition. I'm Paula Degnan. Now joining us on Special Edition today, Intercom's Frank Andrews and Mark Davis. They had the opportunity earlier this week on National Law Enforcement Appreciation Day to talk to some people involved in the law enforcement community. They include U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Pennsylvania, David Freed, and Pennsylvania State Police Trooper Alex Douglas. On National Law Enforcement Appreciation Day, it is an opportunity to recognize law enforcement professionals and the jobs that they do every day, especially being involved in the COVID-19 pandemic. They are as well on the front lines. We're going to start off with the U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Pennsylvania, David Freed.
The gentleman who challenges us to remember this every year is the U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Pennsylvania, David Freed, and he is on the line with us right now. Attorney Freed, thank you so much for reminding us again, and thank you for being part of our show.
Well, thanks for having me back on, Frank. I appreciate it.
Why is this so important to you? This is a big issue for you, and I respect you for that.
Well, you know, Frank, especially now in 2020, I mean, certainly now because of this pandemic, you know, police officers take their lives in their hands every day. You know, they're facing deadly enemies every day when they go out there, and now they're facing this deadly virus too. But even more than that, or along with that, you know, we're at a place in society where you know, we seem to be always on the attack against law enforcement. And we forget the job that they're out there doing every day to protect us and keep us safe. The little things that police do every day, you know, that don't show up in the headlines, that aren't getting Netflix documentaries made about them. Just the police work that's done every day to protect people, to keep people safe. I think it gets forgotten sometimes. And you know, having been a prosecutor for more than 20 years, more and more, I think it's vital for us to remind people what's going on out there every day, and that we have these people. And it's not just police, as you just mentioned. You know, it's air marshals, corrections officers. Our corrections officers are doing an incredible job during this pandemic. Everybody out there on the front lines, they're out there sacrificing for us every day. The least that we can do is to be vocal about showing them appreciation.
You know, David, we saw a police car that was parked this morning on our way to get some coffee. And so I pulled up and I said, hey, we're doing law enforcement appreciation. Can I get you a coffee? And of course, he said no. But my kids were in the car and they started going, officer, hello. He was their resource officer from school. And it just made me happy that they knew him. He took time to get to know the kids. And there was a respect there, which I really want to happen, our younger generation to respect our law enforcement officials.
You know, I do too. And you know, this the media cycle that we live in, you know, we can't unring the bell, Frank. It's not like it used to be. But that makes it even more important for those of us who understand what's going on out there, who are working with police officers and law enforcement every day, to be vocal about it and push back. And thankfully, I have a forum, you know, so I get to come on great shows like this. I get to put things out on social media. And just to make sure I remind people what's going on, you know, I used to say, especially when I was a DA, you know, and my people were having a tough day, I would say, listen, you know, the people are with us. And I think there's a vast, vast silent majority out there. I'm not talking about politics. I'm talking about people who just appreciate what law enforcement officers do to keep them safe. And, you know, I wish, frankly, more of them would speak up. I think we're seeing more of that now. And, you know, the idea of police officers, school resource officers, we have a school resource officer in the school where my kids go. And it's not the kind of school, you know, thankfully I live in a really safe community. And you probably wouldn't need a police officer in that school, but the school and the community think it's important. And it's been the best thing in the world. The kids all know him. He knows the kids. And it just promotes safety and respect.
You know, David, it seems to me like the bad guys have gotten worse, or the bad guys have gotten better armed, or the bad guys have become more hateful. And it just makes the whole situation more complicated.
Well, you know, over the last, you know, you want to call it a decade maybe, one of the things that I've seen is that criminals have gotten younger and more violent. You know, a lot of that has to do with breakdowns in society that we don't have time to solve. certainly today during the short window. But it's a dangerous, dangerous job. And, you know, Frank, I'll give an example. One of the places that we're focused on prosecuting gun crime, you know, we have evidence that's developed and intelligence that's developed that the drug dealers, you know, violent drug dealers especially, know that they're smarter to put the guns in the hands of the younger kids and juveniles, because certainly they know the feds, well, we can't prosecute juveniles. And, you know, those kids will only take a hit at the state level. And, you know, young kids, they want to belong. They want to feel important. It's a very tough battle, excuse me, for us. And we need to be out there. It's a community-wide response. You know, it requires not just strict enforcement. It certainly, you know, any program that says that strict enforcement isn't a part of it, I don't think it'll ever be a successful program. But, you know, we have to have reentry programs, community building, and part of that is being out there and talking about it and continuing to ring that bell.
David, is there anything that, as a community, other than respect and thanks, is there anything that we can be doing to help law enforcement?
Well, I think we have to be as cooperative as possible. I think, you know, Frank, I just mentioned intelligence that was developed. You would be surprised, or I think maybe your listeners would be surprised, at the kind of intel that's developed from people calling in with tips. Call those tip lines. You can be anonymous. When you see something, say something. You know, and demand, frankly, of your elected officials that they are responsive to you about your concerns. I know there's some great groups up there in the Northeast. You know, there's folks who've lost, you know, children and family members to overdoses. They're very engaged with the city of Wilkes-Barre, with Luzerne County, with City of Hazleton. And, you know, they attend meetings and they're vocal. And the elected officials, to their credit, are very responsive to those folks. And I think I think people should demand accountability from appointed officials like me and also from elected officials.
You know, we put on our Facebook page that we were going to have this program today, and someone stopped me in one of the stores and said, you know, I never really thought about it, but if you have somebody that, you know, opens their store in defiance, you might have a police officer who is their neighbor who just has to go out and enforce the law even though they don't want to. And the fellow said to me, that's got to be a very uncomfortable situation, and yet our law enforcement officials have to do what they're sworn to do, even if they are uncomfortable.
Yeah, I am very concerned for the safety of our police officers who are out there, you know, enforcing the law, and you know, like it or not, what's going on, these orders have been challenged, and the state Supreme Court has spoken. The U.S. Supreme Court, you know, denied an emergency challenge. I saw an interaction on Facebook yesterday that a business owner in South Central Pennsylvania, where I live, filmed, and it was very cordial. He was very polite to the police officers. The police officers did a masterful job of speaking with him and giving him his verbal warning. And I would just hope that you know, if there are business owners who feel like they have to open because they've got to feed their families and pay their mortgages, and that's a completely understandable thing, just have the respect for those officers and understand that they're doing a job too.
All right, last question. For all of the law enforcement officials, for all the families of law enforcement officials, for the people who are listening now, what personal message do you have for them on this day?
I am so grateful and thankful for their continued dedication and sacrifice on behalf of all of us every day. It has been the honor of my life to be able to work so closely with law enforcement for so many years. It's just, I get up every day and I love going to work, and that has everything to do with the incredible people that are out there serving our community that I've had a chance to work with, and I just deeply, deeply appreciate that.
And I appreciate you. Thank you very much, U.S. Attorney David Freed. Thank you for joining us, sir. On the line is Pennsylvania State Trooper Alex Douglas. Alex, how are you today?
Very good, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Good. Thank you very much for joining us. Police appreciation, law enforcement appreciation. The first thing I want to do is I want to thank you for your service to our community, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Now, for the benefit of the audience, Could you take us back to 2014, what happened? Because the reason I'm asking you to recount it is so that people can understand how our law enforcement officials put their lives on the line every day, if you don't mind, sir.
Sure. So September 12th of 2014, myself and three other state troopers were on our way into the Blooming Grove State Police Barracks up in Pike County to work a midnight shift. And as we arrived, I'm going to go back a little bit. The previous morning, I worked an overtime construction zone shift, so I was already in uniform and had a marked state police vehicle. So I was the only one in uniform. So as we pulled into the barracks that night, the three other troopers that I was with, they had to go in and change in the uniforms, and I just happened to be out in the parking lot putting stuff in my personal vehicle when I heard what sounded like fireworks going off. They were pretty simultaneous, so as I heard the simultaneous loud bangs, I went up into the front of the barracks and noticed, and I observed one of our troopers was laying out in front of the barracks on the ground. And so as I got closer to him, I realized that he was shot and wounded. And the next thing I wanted to do was to try to get him inside the barracks of safety. And as I was trying to pull him inside, I was shot through the left side of my lower back, and the bullet went through my intestines, which is a 308 round, and exited outside to my right hip, shattering my right hip. So I dropped instantly to the ground on my knees and crawled inside the barracks. As I got into the lobby area of the barracks, two other troopers came and pulled me inside of safety, and then a couple other troopers started doing, giving me medical attention. Then I was life flighted to CMC Geisinger, where I spent about 30 days in the hospital there, and then went to Allied Services Rehabilitation Center for a couple days, and then I was flown back out to New York City to the hospitals out there. I had a total hip reconstruction. I had a colostomy bag on my stomach. I lost 2 feet of my small intestine due to the wound, and that was actually reversed. And just December 12th of 2018, I had to have my below my knee right leg amputated because of the nerve. When the bullet went through me, it actually hit my sciatic nerve on that side. So I was suffering from a lot of chronic pain. Nerve pain, so I had to have the right leg amputated at that point.
Alex, you know, we do this every year, police or law enforcement appreciation, but you don't really ask to be thanked. You just do your job. But maybe you could just talk a little bit about, I mean, certainly you didn't expect to be shot. I mean, you were in a construction zone. I can understand where you would put your life on the line there from an accident or something. But there are people out there that are just filled with hate. And so I think it's so necessary for us to just appreciate the work of law enforcement.
Yeah, unfortunately, Frank, like in today's society, you know, we weren't the only troopers that were ambushed. You know, it was kind of across the nation. There's two police officers in New York City that right after our incident that got ambushed, I believe down in Texas and again down in Georgia. It's kind of a repetitive event, unfortunately. And, you know, any local, state, or federal, you know, police officers, like you said, we put our lives on the line and try to help the community and try to help the citizens of the country. And we have people that, you know, unfortunately want to hurt us and harm us. But, you know, this week for Police Week, last year, I was actually a year ago, I was down in Washington, D.C. with a company called the Thin Blue Line USA. They took me down there, and it was the first time I was there. It was the first time I actually saw the National Police Memorial, which was pretty impressive and very touching at the same time. But what Police Week is all about is, you know, we're doing an observance and paying tribute to, like I said, any local, state, and federal police officers who have died or have been wounded and disabled in the line of duty.
It's incredible. Alex, how old are you now?
I'm 37, Frank.
And how old were you when you first became a law enforcement officer?
I was 22.
And 22. Why? Why did you do that? Why did you decide that that's what your calling was?
Well, it's kind of funny because I went to the University of Scranton and I took, I have 2 degrees, one in finance and one in economics. And, you know, my professors at the university were actually pushing me to go for my doctor in economics because I enjoyed it, but I was also good at it. And, you know, I really wanted to do a little more. I didn't want to sit behind a desk. I couldn't, I didn't want to be crunching numbers all day. I wanted to be active and, you know, how about with the community, serving the community? I originally was thinking about going into the military, and I figured going into the Pennsylvania State Police, which is a paramilitary organization, that it would be also beneficial to stay, you know, domestically, because the war was going on. My parents are saying to me, you know, you could get killed over there if you join the military. You'll get sent overseas, and then, you know, this happened to me, so I had to turn it around on them and say, look what happened to me, you know. But like I said, one of the main reasons was I wanted to be proactive, and that's what our department's all about, being proactive and helping the community out.
And you're still helping the community out. You still, when you were here last year, we had a conversation, this is Mark Davis, we had a conversation in the hallway about some of the speaking engagements you continue to do to share your story, but also share what law enforcement's all about. And tell us a little bit about that, because you haven't given up the cause because of your injuries and your situation. You still continue to carry that banner proudly.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. My outlook was always, you know, the community, after I was wounded, the community helped us out. You know, it helped my family out with different events and benefits and everything, and raising mm-hmm. money to help out my family. And, you know, this is one way for me to serve the community as I once was, you know, doing my public speaking and encouraging people that nothing can hold you back. You can't let, you know, no matter what it is, you know, unfortunately, if you're in a bad car accident or whatever it may be, you know, you got to keep pushing forward and make a negative situation a positive one. You know?
And it would have been very easy for you to say, I don't want to do that. I don't want to talk to other people. My situation is what it is. But yet you're giving other people hope and honor and what you've been through, and trying to motivate them to continue to do well and do things for the community and for others.
Thank you. Yeah, when I was wounded, one of my main goals in life after that was, don't let my injury define who I am.
Well, you've certainly done that, right?
Yep. Thank you.
Alex, I have to ask you, yesterday, the convicted killer, Eric Freen, had an execution date that was set. Now, obviously, there's a moratorium in Pennsylvania, but when you see that, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, what goes through your mind? What is your reaction to that?
Well, like, I'm going to go back a little bit. When we had the trial, I kind of, you know, in the public speaking events, I always kind of tell the story about the trial, and you know, I was dreading when the trial was approaching, because I didn't want to relive that in that type of environment and tell my story in that type of environment. And, you know, when the trial actually happened and went through, I was actually, enlightened by what everyone has done during that investigation, all different authorities, all different organizations, and what they did to help us out. It was quite amazing. And I learned a lot of information during that trial that, you know, I didn't know before. And, you know, when the sentencing actually happened, I felt that, you know, that individual, I'm a believer in an eye for an eye. And I was very pleased with the outcome of that trial and what the verdict was. And when I saw that outcome yesterday with, Secretary of Prisons John Wetzel, I felt that same emotion, you know, very satisfied, and I thought that was a great thing what he did.
Alex, one last question. For all of the law enforcement officials in any division, whether, you know, someone called and said, Frank, don't forget the police that are guarding the railroads. I mean, there are law enforcement officials everywhere. On this week, on this day when we are saying thank you, what message would you give to those people who have dedicated their life to service?
You know, you're doing a great thing. Keep fighting the fight. And no matter how bad it gets, keep pushing forward. Turn it into a positive situation. You're doing a great deed, and keep up the good work.
Alex, you're my friend. You're a good man. We appreciate you being here. And again, as I began the interview, we end it. Thank you for your service to our
community. Thank you.
It's our pleasure here on Special Edition to give Trooper Alex Douglas and U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Pennsylvania, David Freed, an opportunity for you to hear their stories about National Law Enforcement Appreciation Day, and to give us the opportunity to say thank you to all the men and women in the national law enforcement community. I certainly hope that you won't go away. More to come on Special Edition. We're going to hear from Dr. Jaewon Roo from Geisinger, and we're also going to find out how COVID-19 is affecting the environment. Special Edition. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Special Edition. Now we're going to meet Dr. Jaewon Roo, President and CEO of Geisinger. Intercom's Rocky and Lissa spoke with Dr. Roo on the prospect of getting back to a new normal and what it's like if you want to visit someone in the hospital today.
Dr. Roo, we were talking about this yesterday. Some of the local businesses that are talking about trying to open back up, and some even are pushing the envelope on opening early. What would you tell them?
I think it's what we've been emphasizing all along. You know, this is not the time to let up on the efforts. We do think there's a safe way to reopen segments of society. I think the governor's approach and the state approach makes a lot of sense as far as doing it based on activity level in the immediate area surrounding, you know, that county, basing that on, you know, this color assessment of in the red and the yellow and so forth. But it's a difficult time for everybody. You know, small businesses are taking a big hit, and obviously health systems are as well. So we totally can appreciate that. But I think it's all about, as you reopen, doing so carefully and adhering to kind of the system and the approach, whether it's paying attention to new cases or new activity, local hotspots. I think all of that kind of stuff is very important. It's also, I think, if you look at the state's guidelines, whether you're in yellow or red, it tends to ban any large gatherings. The only difference is one has a ban on anything above 25 people, and the other is very general. But I think that is consistent with what we've been saying and the science as well. We actually just had some town halls, some virtual town halls with the coordinated through, I think, over a dozen chambers of commerce. And a lot of these kinds of questions came up. And what we've been telling folks is kind of giving them a toolkit, these small businesses, as far as what the consideration should be, whether it's screening or masking guidelines, the proper role of assessing their employees, how they can create distancing and spacing depending on the workforce. And we know also that a big part of the message is COVID is not gone, and it won't be gone anytime soon. And so it's all about managing even in light of having COVID around. So I think these are some of the communication points, and we've been trying to get out there and offer up our assistance with small businesses as far as helping them with the toolkit and otherwise.
Any advice for any of our listeners with a non-COVID illness that it's okay to visit a hospital like Geisinger?
Yeah, I'd say our hospitals and clinics are safe, and they're as safe as ever and possibly even safer. I mean, I can't tell you how many precautions and steps kind of go through each and every sort of process or workflow or patient flow issue. I think, one, I would start with the fact that we have all of the COVID units in separate designated areas, and they're on different HVAC systems under negative pressure, different staff. So there's a lot of separation there. We've even created separation outside of each and every one of our emergency rooms. You'll see these tents up where people get screened even before they enter the building, and anybody who's able to sort of be shunted in one direction gets diverted that way. We're screening everybody who comes in our doors. We're masking everybody who comes through our doors. We continue with our limitation of visitors. I think the other thing that folks, as they come back in and we're starting to see more activity pick up, both in the clinics and in the hospitals, but they'll see that the waiting rooms and how they stagger are very different as well. So we're spacing appointments out, which creates less foot traffic in the building, but also when they're coming into the building, we're spacing them out as far as where the seats are in the waiting room, arranging exam rooms appropriately so that they're not in contact with high-touch environments. The other thing that's something that we've been keeping track of is our employees, the positive testing rate. So of those who get tested, how many come back or what percentage comes back positive? It's half the rate that we see for non-employees that we test. I think that's a tribute to the fact that we've really paid attention to making it a safe environment. And so if you're a non-COVID patient, curious about, is it safe to come back? I could absolutely reassure you that it is.
How are we doing locally on flattening the old curve?
I'll say I think we're in a decent spot, but it's one of these things where you can never rest on this. And until we have a meaningful vaccine, which is still going to be a far ways off, I think we're going to have to figure out as a society, as a community, how to manage well through the COVID crisis. And so all of these precautions become absolutely important. And, you know, some of this is statistics. If you have a variety of precautions that each reduce your chance of spread by a little bit, then collectively, if we're successful in doing all of those, then you've got a significant reduction in risk and spread. And so it's way too early to think we're out of the woods, but there are safe ways to reopen segments of society and, for us, you know, services inside the hospital and the clinics. But in order to keep staying in a pretty good spot, we got to make sure that we're being super attentive to things like spacing, masking, distancing, hand hygiene, not touching the face. I think it's all of the same things we've been talking about. That's what's going to get us through this thing. And thus far, I think a lot of the communities that we're in, we've been pretty good at that. I think we got to make sure we double down on it, because there's a greater chance now that functions are going to reopen in society, and we can't all rush out and think that we're all in the clear. I think that would be what lands us in a bad spot. We got to think of it as doubling down on all of those efforts, even while we know that we could reopen some functions.
Can we end with a positive story, maybe something you've seen somewhere in the Geisinger system?
So a couple things. I think the things, just reflecting back on this past week, one thing is both at our GWV facility in Wilkes-Barre and or in Luzerne County, and then our GCMC facility in Lackawanna up in Scranton, both of them celebrated a big milestone this past week. They discharged their 100th patient, each campus did, that had COVID.
Wow.
That means, you know, at least 100 people on each campus that have made a full recovery, and they were able to go home. So I think that's tremendous.
That's wonderful.
And then the other, I've mentioned to you once before, there have been some reports across the internet, you know, should every patient that gets discharged, should they have sort of like a celebration song as they walk out of the hospital? And we, you know, a lot of our staff have been eager to do that. I'm told that two of the most popular songs, I don't know if you can guess what they are, but one is Walking on Sunshine by Katrina and the Waves.
That's
oh, there
a great
we go.
One.
And the other is Here Comes the Sun by the Beatles. So
oh,
those are
perfect.
Probably two of the more common ones we're seeing.
Oh, that's so wonderful.
So it's good stuff. Yeah, there's a lot of good going on. I can't emphasize that enough. And of course, our employees and our, you know, the care teams are just, I mean, I've used this term before with you all, but they really are rising to the occasion, as are the community. I mean, people are banding together, coming together. It's amazing. And so that kind of teamwork is definitely helping us all out.
Yeah, we noticed that a lot, too. And your team is the best of the best. Please pass along our love and gratitude from us and our listeners to all of them.
Oh, my goodness. Very kind of you. And I will. I will.
Now we welcome one of our Intercom sister stations on COVID-19 and the environment.
I'm Karina Delgado with 94.7 The Drive. I am on the phone today with the Vice President of Conservation International to speak about our Earth, the environment, and the COVID-19 crisis, and how the two are inextricably intertwined. Hi, Shyla. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for calling, Karina. I'm doing really well, thanks. How are you?
I am doing the best that I can every single day, just staying grateful and washing my hands.
Exactly. Same here.
If you could, just please take a moment to introduce yourself to our listeners.
Great. Thanks. My name is Shyla Raghav. I am the Vice President of Climate Change at Conservation International, and my role is to oversee our climate change strategy and programs. Conservation International is present in about 30 countries around the world, and we have our headquarters is in Arlington, Virginia, and our mission is really about protecting nature for the well-being of humanity. And so the types of solutions that I work on are stopping deforestation, providing support and guidance to governments and to local communities to find investment solutions, policy solutions to protect nature for a more sustainable and healthy future.
Sure. Speaking of protection, we are all in protective mode right now. With that said, I think, comes a sense of question, and people are speculating on whether or not the COVID-19 pandemic is a result of climate change. Can you speak to that a little bit for me?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really important question. And I think that our tendency is always to try to find connections between trends, but also to be able to find or get some good news, right, or find a silver lining amidst everything that we're experiencing. There isn't really any strong evidence that climate change is a direct cause of the coronavirus and its spread. But what we do know is that climate change is has a direct influence on the migration of species. And so in particular, what we're seeing is that ranges of species, whether it's even trees and plants where they can grow, or migratory patterns of species like fish or even birds and insects, these are all changing because of shifts in temperature and precipitation that is being caused by climate change. But I'd also like to highlight the fact that climate change is something that could multiply the losses and damages in times of crisis. So imagine if on top of dealing with COVID-19, we were also experiencing a drought or cataclysmic fires like we saw in Australia or in the Amazon. Well, it would really just have the impact of exacerbating those inequalities.
As we experience in our own communities the COVID-19 crisis, I can only imagine the devastation somewhere that was, you know, hit by a tornado during a time like this.
Exactly. And climate change can also affect human health even more by putting strain on vulnerable populations, or even increasing things like heat stress or the spread of disease vectors like mosquitoes that increase incidence of diseases like malaria. And so the human health implications are really going to be even more difficult to deal with when compounded with viruses and diseases like COVID-19. So I really think the main message here is that climate change and human health are inextricably linked.
What we're seeing as a result of people social distancing and isolating in their homes is that pollution levels have dropped around the world as people stay home. Do you think this will inspire people to limit their fossil fuel use once things get back to normal?
I think that's also another trend that we're seeing so much in the news. And I think, you know, as I mentioned, I think everyone's looking for something positive to come out of all of the negative consequences of COVID-19. But I wouldn't necessarily call the drop in air pollution levels a hidden benefit, because they're likely just going to be temporary. And we haven't really, as a society, made the systemic shift that are needed for these gains to persist or be sustained in the long term. So the way that I'd rather look at some of these short-term benefits is to focus on preparation and how we could have prepared better. So imagine if we had listened to the warnings from epidemiologists and others and prepared, right, 5, 6, 10 years ago. How different would that outcome have been in terms of how we're dealing with and experiencing losses due to this crisis right now? How would we have changed the future, and how would we have acted to do that, even just so that the virus could be contained or mitigated and our economy could be more resilient and prepared for that? So I think with climate change, the timeline is very clear, and so are the consequences. Mm. So the question that we have now is, how will we use these next few years, knowing what we know now and knowing that we have the opportunity to prepare better and to create a more resilient economy, so that we don't have to lose jobs, we don't have to decimate our economy. We can actually address climate change by building new and clean and thriving economies. So that's really what I hope we can take away from our lessons from dealing with COVID-19.
What can we do to make those preparations?
Yeah. So in the next 10 years, the science is really clear. Emissions need to be halved by 2030. So we basically have a decade to cut our emissions in half. And we know the types of solutions that can get us there. So it's clean and renewable energy. It's greening our agriculture system and our food system through regenerative agriculture and shifting towards more of a plant-based diet. Shifting to public transportation, reduction of overall consumption like plastics, and other products that take a lot of energy to produce. So making those immediate changes now in our infrastructure, in our decisions, and our patterns today can set us up to be in a position to really achieve that outcome over the next 10 years. The second thing I would say is that since climate change is fundamentally, like COVID-19, a global crisis, it's going to require worldwide cooperation and attention to really focus on a coherent and coordinated global response, where we can see a basis for global signals, global alignment and redirecting of financial flows. And so that's the second thing I would say, is just really band together through political signals and political processes that can help develop a global response. And then the last thing I would say is to support natural climate solutions, which includes planting of trees, restoration of natural ecosystems, and protection of standing forests. This is really my personal passion, because a third or more of the solution to climate change comes from protecting and restoring nature. And guess what? These solutions can also help maintain the resilience of our planet, provide us with clean air and clean water, and might also very well prevent the spread of viruses that so severely affect human health as well.
One last thing, Shaila, before I let you go. What is one way individuals can give back to nature and be a part of the bigger climate solution at the same time?
2020 is such an important year. So I think making addressing climate change a priority, making it a voting issue, an investment lens when you're looking at where you put your investments, your retirement portfolios, make it demands that we make as shareholders and consumers of many large companies, talking about it more. There's really something that every single person can do, no matter what your skill set, to activate creativity and kind of that ideation process of bringing solutions to the market. The other thing that people can do is use a tool that we developed that is available on our webpage. It's a carbon calculator, and it allows users to measure their carbon footprint and give back to conservation projects designed to keep forests standing and to help scale up restoration efforts. So listeners can visit conservation.org/calculator. And after using the calculator and assessing their carbon footprint, they can learn more about reforestation and conservation projects to which a donation can help support forests in the Amazon, in places like Peru or Kenya. And so this is really something specific and tangible that everyone can do immediately, and can also help us to maintain our optimism, our hope, and our sense of community in coming together around addressing climate change and protecting our planet for our future.
Can you give us the website one more time, please?
Absolutely. It's conservation.org/calculator.
Thanks again to Carissa Delgado from our Intercom sister station 94.7 The Drive in Washington, D.C. on how COVID-19 is affecting the environment. And thank you for joining us this week on Special Edition.
COVID-19 is a severe lung infection. Trust the American Lung Association for science-based public health information, especially for the 36 million Americans who live with lung disease. We have resources to protect your lung health, access expertise from medical professionals, and peer-to-peer support through our online communities. Visit lung.org for daily updates or call 1-800-LUNG-USA.
Thanks for listening to Special Edition, a weekly look at the issues in the news and the personalities shaping the stories, a production of Intercom Communications.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.